Jehovah Shammah, the Lord is there. We have two texts that we're going to refer to during this teaching. The first one's from Ezekiel 48:35. Ezekiel 48:35, and here's the reference to God's name. It says, in the name of the city, from that time on will be, the Lord is there, Jehovah Shammah. And the name of the city from that time on will be Jehovah Shammah, the Lord is there. And then the second text is Revelation 21:1-4. Revelation 21:1-4. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. Today we're going to look at another name of God in the reference here. We're going to look at Ezekiel 48:35, Jehovah Shammah. We've been doing a series on the names of God. And this one, Jehovah Shammah, the Lord is there, or Jehovah is there, refers to God's presence being there. God is there. It's not just an attribute or a characteristics of God. It's the person of God is there. However, to look at that, we want to look at Ezekiel and see the context that Ezekiel's referring to. We also want to look at see the city that Ezekiel's referring to. What is that city? And is there any correlation between the city that Ezekiel speaks about and also the city that I mentioned in Revelation 21:1-4, the New Jerusalem? And the other thing we want to look at is what is the importance of God's name and presence to us? When we say Jehovah Shammah, what does it mean to us of being in God's presence? So first of all, we want to look at the context surrounding Ezekiel at this point in time. We're going to look at several parts of this. Ezekiel was in Babylon at the time that he gave this word. So at that time when he gave this word in Babylon, he was with the exiles of Jerusalem in Babylon. At that time, it was about 14 years after Jerusalem had fallen and 25th year of captivity in Babylon. Now, the southern kingdom the southern kingdom part of Israel is who's in exile. Now, the southern kingdom is comprised primarily of Judah and Benjamin. So when Jeroboam and Rehoboam, there was a split there of the tribes. 10 tribes went to Jeroboam, 2 remained with Rehoboam, and Judah and Benjamin are the two. But eventually, part of the southern kingdom, which we refer to as Judah or Judah and Benjamin, there's a number of others from the other 10 tribes that had come back to there. And they actually include a good part of the Levites and also people from Ephraim, Manasseh, and Simeon. So even though we say there's two tribes, there's also another number of people from the other tribes that are with them. And for consistency and try to keep the terms correctly, one of the words I'm going to use when I refer to the people in exile, I'm going to call them the Jews. And the name Jews actually comes from Judah. The region of Judah. So when the people went in exile, they came from that region. So they're referred to as Jews in the exile, and then from then on. Now, at the time of Ezekiel's revelation of Jehovah Shammah, he's in captivity. He's in exile over in Babylon. But what's going on back in the land of Israel? What is that? Again, we said this is about 14 years after Jerusalem had fallen. What is it like back there? The temple of God has been ransacked and destroyed. The temple that the Jews looked to for God's presence had been destroyed by Babylon. All the utensils, all the things that were made out of gold and silver that were in the temple were taken away off to Babylon. Years later, they actually tried to make some more, but eventually those got taken too because Israel was in rebellion later on with Babylon. So there's multiple times that Jerusalem's going to go through this exile. There's several deportations of Jews that are going to go to Babylon. Now, what about the city of Jerusalem? The city of Jerusalem had also been ransacked by the Babylonians. The buildings were burnt down. The palace that Solomon had built, was burnt down. All the important buildings were burnt down. The city was put to fire, and the walls were broken down. So Jerusalem was devastated. And you can see that in Jeremiah 52, 12, and 13. And this all happens around 586 BC. So this gives us a reference of what we're talking about, the time frame. And again, there's all the deportations of the Jews. Ezekiel was one of the first ones to go to Babylon. And you think of other narratives in Scripture, Daniel and his friends are going to go into exile. And so that's the physical environment at that point in time. What's the spiritual environment at that time? Ezekiel is one of the prophets who's prophesying judgment against Judah because of her sin. And this time, if you read into the Old Testament, if you do a study, and this is a good study to do, they'll take time to go through, read through the minor prophets. Read through the major prophets. But if you don't know what's going on with the minor prophet, find something that gives an introduction to that minor prophet, because they fit in. They fit in with the kings, 1st and 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles. They're going to fit in with Ezra and Nehemiah as the people come back to rebuild the temple and rebuild Jerusalem. And so there's a number of the Old Testament books that fit in together with what's going on in this time frame. And to see the wickedness that was going on in both Israel and Judah, you'll see that with the prophets. Though today we're basically going to speak of Judah and the prophets that were prophesying toward Judah about their sin. Ezekiel is one of them. What is the purpose of Ezekiel in the prophets? We find that in Amos 3:7. It says, "Surely the sovereign Lord does nothing without revealing his plan to his servants, the prophets." Again, it's Amos 3:7. "Surely the sovereign Lord does nothing without revealing his plan to his servant, the prophets." If you look into the history of the prophets, I looked that up to find out where did these prophets come from? Because you see very little prophetic activity or the prophets being mentioned prior to the kings. You see Abraham referred to as a prophet. You see Moses and Aaron being the prophet for Moses when he goes to Pharaoh. But you don't see much of what the prophets are there for. But at the time when Israel rejects God, and Samuel goes through that, and when Israel rejects Samuel, Samuel said, "They're rejecting me." And God says, "No, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me." God gave them kings, but God also gave his voice to the people of Israel also, and he gave them the prophets. And so you'll see the intertwining of the kings and the prophets through history, through the narratives. So the kings could do what they want, but they had these other groups over here, these prophets and prophets, who they eventually disliked. And they eventually would want to kill them if they could, because the voice of the prophet was to hear God. And God was revealing his plan to the prophets. Now, there's a lot more I could say about the prophets. Again, there's the major prophets and the minor prophets. What's the difference between the two? Major prophets had longer books. Minor prophets had shorter books. It's very simple. So you'll see these minor prophets, and you can read through a minor prophet, Obadiah, real quick. There's a short one. But it's like, what's going on there? Read the history about what Obadiah was doing at the time. And do that as a study. Just go through the prophets and find out God's plan for Israel and how God's plan also fits with us. But now back to Ezekiel and the exile. Why are the Jews in exile? There's several reasons. There's several things that we can actually point to. And these are the ones we're going to look at today, or the ones we'll refer to today. One of the reasons they're in exile is they were seeking after false gods. One of the prophets, Amos 2, 4 and 5. Amos 2, 4 and 5. "This is what the Lord says. For three sins of Judah, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath. Because they have rejected the law of the Lord and have not kept his decrees. Because they have been led astray by false gods, the gods their ancestors followed. I will send fire upon Judah that will consume the fortresses of Jerusalem." This is the prophecy against the city of Jerusalem, that God will purge that city by his fire. And he will use Babylon to do it. Why? Because they went after false gods. You would think at that time in Israel's history, by the time they got to the kings, they should know better about following false gods. They have all the examples through the judges. They have the examples of where they pursued some of this even on their travels to the promised land. They have the examples of the tribes or the nations that God used them to destroy in the promised land to give that land over to Israel. You would think that they would know better. But they still pursued false gods. And they followed the same gods that caused them to receive judgment of God from in the past. Another point why the Jews are in exile. Manasseh, one of Judah's kings, had also pursued other gods. He had sacrificed his sons in the fire. He put idols in God's temple. And we read a little about it in 2 Kings 23. And you can read more about it in 2 Kings. This is the portion we'll look at. 2 Kings 23, 26, and 27. Nevertheless, the Lord did not turn away from the heat of his fierce anger, which burned against Judah because of all that Manasseh had done to provoke him to anger. So the Lord said, I will remove Judah also from my presence as I removed Israel. And I will reject Jerusalem, the city I chose, and this temple about which I said, there shall my name be. It's important where God places his name. And when God places his name there, it's important how we relate to that. And God had placed his name in Jerusalem. He chose to. He didn't have to. God placed his name in the temple. He didn't have to. But God chose a people, and he chose to place his name there, and they rejected it. And actually, in this passage in 2 Kings 23, 26, and 27, this is after Manasseh's grandson, Josiah, had brought reform back to Israel. And as wicked as Manasseh had been, Josiah had a zeal to go and purge everything that was going on after that, to remove all the things that would cause God's anger. But God said, that's not enough. How wicked was Manasseh? Manasseh was so wicked. Manasseh, when you read about what he did and his provoking of God to anger, it's almost as Manasseh woke up each day and said, what provokes God to anger? I'm going to do that today. And the next day, what can I do that will provoke God to anger? I'm going to do that today. I'm going to do evil. I'm going to do whatever I can. It doesn't matter what God says. This is what I'm going to do today. This is the type of king that was leading Israel at the time. Some of the things that he did, he practiced sorcery and divination. He rebuilt high places, not to worship God, which they were not supposed to build high places in the first place, but he built high places so they could worship other gods. He made altars to Baals and Asherah. Go back through the history, Israel. Go back and see what happened in the past when you built those things. What was God's attitude at the time toward you as a nation when you did those things? We never read of the history of Israel that God showed favor when they were doing those things. We always see God's judgment as meted out toward Israel when they do those things. He sacrificed his sons in the fire. They did more evil than the nations the Lord had destroyed before the Israelites. So God had brought judgment in the land. When God brought the Israelite nation in the promised land, he took out nations that had done evil. Manasseh made it a point to do more evil than all of them. So God's anger was on fire. Another part of Manasseh that we also read about in 2 Kings is Manasseh shed innocent blood in Jerusalem. And in the same place where he saw that God said his name would be, in 2 Kings 24, 3, surely these things happened to Judah according to the Lord's command, in order to remove them from his presence because of the sins of Manasseh and all he had done, including the shedding of innocent blood. For he had filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, and the Lord was not willing to forgive. Would you want to be in that place where God says, I am not going to forgive you? He shed so much blood. In fact, tradition even says that he may have been involved in the martyrdom of Isaiah at the time frame. But he destroyed what represented God, and he built up what represented other false gods. Now, the good news, if you read more about Manasseh later on, there is a place of repentance for Manasseh later, because he goes into Assyrian captivity for a while, and he repents. But what he had done and what he had brought the nation of Israel to brought them to such anger toward God that God said, even when Josiah, his grandson, came along, he says, I will not forgive. I will bring my judgment. I am forced to bring my judgment. Now, it's also as part of this whole thing that Ezekiel is prophesying in the book of Ezekiel and coming up to that place, as God's pushing Israel away from his presence, we also see through some of Ezekiel's visions that God's presence also departed. In Ezekiel 10, you can actually see that the glory of God departs the temple. In Ezekiel 11, if you do want to look at studying Ezekiel, you can also see the glory of God departing the city. So God's going to depart the temple of God that was made by Solomon. God's going to depart Jerusalem, the city that was set aside for God. And throughout the Old Testament, we can see the glory of God related to the physical manifestation of God. And here we see God removing his presence as he's getting ready to execute judgment on Israel, and which will end up with the exiles going to Babylon. What's that judgment like? What's it like to be under the judgment of God when God displays his anger and removes his presence and takes a number of Israelites out to Babylon? What are some of the verses that come through? We might think of it like, oh, they went into exile. Okay, they shipped a bunch of us here and just sent us to California. Okay, I live in California. It's not that way. That's not what it was like. Ezekiel 14:21 says, "For this is what the sovereign Lord says. How much worse would it be when I send against Jerusalem my four dreadful judgments, sword and famine and wild beast and plague, to kill its men and their animals." God has four judgments. How would you like to wake up thinking, what's my day going to be like today? Which judgment of God is going to take me out? Am I going to die by sword? Am I going to die by famine? Am I going to die by wild beast? Am I going to die by plague? A number of these things that happen are reflected also in Lamentations. Lamentations is though it doesn't specify the author, it's looked at, is set, it appears to be Jeremiah, the prophet who was still in Jerusalem when the exiles went off to Babylon. Jeremiah is a contemporary of Ezekiel, probably an older contemporary, but his prophecy, what he is saying, is appearing at the same time these judgments are going on. These are some of the judgments as we see them. I'm not going to refer to all of them, but we'll see some of the four. In Lamentations 1:11, it says, "All her people groan as they search for bread. They barter their treasures for food to keep themselves alive." This was Jerusalem. This was Jerusalem where a few centuries back, King Solomon and Jerusalem were so rich, silver was everywhere. It says it was like the stones. Gold was everywhere. And yet all the treasure that they had does nothing when they have to search for food. The famine also affects the children and the infants. After hearing what Meg shared and Duke shared about their child, Lamentations 2:11-12, the despair that you have when you see your child, there's nothing you can do. We see it in Lamentations 2:11-12, "My eyes fail from weeping. I am in torment within. My heart is poured out on the ground because my people are destroyed, because children and infants faint in the streets of the city. They say to their mothers, 'Where is bread and wine?' As they faint like wounded men in the streets of the city, as their lives ebb away in their mother's arms." And she's sick, and you want her well. What you will do as a mother, when you sit here and think that your children are going out there and they have nothing to eat, and you see them dying in your arms because they say, "I need bread," and you can't do anything about it. This famine is not just getting shipped somewhere. It's the pain where God's going to say, "I'm going to destroy you." It even gets worse. Lamentations 2:20 says, "Look, O Lord, and consider, whom have you ever treated like this? Should women eat their offspring, the children they have cared for? Compassionate women have cooked their own children." This is the desperation for food in Israel. When they're sitting up, and as King Nebuchadnezzar lays siege to Jerusalem, and they're huddled in there and they have no food, and people are starving, this is what they resort to. And how are these children treated by the Babylonians when the Babylonians come and start doing their destruction? This is part of Psalm 137, 7-9, that Deborah, I didn't ask them to read this part, but this is part of Psalm 137 that wasn't given. It says, "Remember, O Lord, what the Edomites did on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundations. O daughter of Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy is he who repays you for what you have done to us. He who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks." It's one thing for what we go through in life. It's another thing to see what happens to our children. And see, again, this is the judgment of God against the wickedness of Israel. How will the women be treated by Babylon? And I actually use the ESV because of the way the wording is. In Lamentations 5:11, it says, "Women are raped in Zion, young women in the towns of Judah." The NIV uses the word ravish. I don't think we use that word as much, understanding. But this is how violent the whole situation is. And I'm sorry if I'm not trying to emphasize the violence. I'm not trying to emphasize for the sake of being graphic, just to be graphic. This is the judgment of God. This is what God can do when God's angry. This is what God will choose to do against sin. We have a holy God. This is what God will do. And if you've made it through some of those things in Jerusalem, if you've made it through the famine, you may still be part of the exile. If you made it through part of the war, a lot of people have gotten killed. There's another verse that speaks out, they'll send out 1,000 and only 100 will come back. They'll send out 100 and only 10 will come back. That's 90% loss of people. And if you've made it through that, then you might be on the trip to Babylon. And it's not a train to Babylon. In fact, when they're coming back from Babylon to rebuild the city, it's 4 months' trip about. So that 4 months' trip, you might fall along the way for the same reasons that you're going through now. Because you're not able to handle that, and you're not going to make it to Babylon. This is the destruction that God sends against his people because of their wickedness. So now we come to Ezekiel by the river Kabar in the text that was read in Psalm 137, 1 to 6. "By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, 'Sing us one of the songs of Zion.'" You've just gone through all this violence. You've just gone through all this tragedy. You're my tormentor and you want me to sing a song? How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land, especially one where I've gone through what you've done to me and I'm supposed to sing one of my songs? "If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. I will remember Jerusalem. I will remember what it was like. But I cannot sing of it right now with what you've done." Where's God? And were all the people of Judah unrighteous? No. But the righteous people had to go through the same sorrow and pain, the same suffering. Lamentations 5:15 says, "Joy is gone from our hearts. Our dancing has turned to mourning." What a contrast in Jerusalem. God's presence has departed. The violence has come. The contrast you look at, remember when David brought the ark to Jerusalem? The ark of God's covenant? The presence of God? What was it like? It was a celebration. There were joys. David was dancing with all his might because of that joy that God's presence was coming to Jerusalem. And later on, when you read of Solomon finishing the temple and the ark of God goes to the temple, the joy, they spent 14 days celebrating the presence of God in the temple, and the glory of God filled the temple, and the presence of God was in the city. Now, in the midst of all that devastation, there's hope. Ezekiel has more visions. And one of the visions he has is the presence of God coming back with the same symbols and the same view that he sees the glory of God departing. The glory of God comes back. And Ezekiel 43:2 says, "And I saw the glory of God of Israel coming from the east. His voice was like the roar of rushing waters, and the land was radiant with his glory." Israel knew, the Jews knew what it was like for the glory of God to depart. We want his radiance back again. Ezekiel 43:4. "The glory of God entered the temple through the gates facing east. And the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court, and the glory of God filled the temple. What does that remind us of? The time back in Solomon where God's glory fills the temple, there's rejoicing, there's celebration, because God's presence is back with his people again. Ezekiel 43:7, he said, "Son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place for the soles of my feet. This is where I will live among the Israelites forever. The house of Israel will never again defile my holy name, neither they nor their kings by their prostitution and the lifeless idols of their kings at their high places." God's presence is back with his people. And God's going to restore Israel and Jerusalem. And so you read Ezra, you read Nehemiah, and this is going to happen around 516 BC when they finish the temple again. As 70 years of exile and going from Jerusalem's original destruction. So now we see everything is good now. Ezekiel sees the revelation then in chapter 48:35. And the name of the city from that time on will be "The Lord is there," Jehovah Shammah. God is there. That's the hope. That's the joy. But is the story complete yet? No, because it still happens in BC. It's not done yet. Is Jerusalem now going to follow after God now that they've restored Jerusalem? Now that they've restored the temple, is Jerusalem going to follow after God with all their heart? And God desires to have his name proclaimed on the city again. Is Ezekiel's prophecy completely fulfilled? And why did I have that extra text in Revelation at the beginning? Let's look at Jerusalem later. Sometimes when a prophet says something, there's immediate meaning that you get right then in the context of the time. But then sometimes there's something for the future, because God's not looking at just the current time. God has a larger perspective than we do. And Ezekiel 48:35 is like that. How's God going to make his presence known to Jerusalem? Through Jesus, his son. Matthew 1:23, which is fulfillment of another prophet, Isaiah 7:14. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. God made his presence known through Jesus. So God's presence is back. And John 1:14 says, the word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. And the word that says he made his dwelling among us is the tent. God made his tabernacle with us. God didn't tabernacle with us again through a tent like the Israelites at the very beginning. God didn't tabernacle again and make his presence known through the temple. God made his presence known through a body. And we see also in that reference also the glory of God that also is referenced in Ezekiel. So God takes his glory, doesn't come back to Jerusalem and to the temple in just the glory that only Ezekiel sees. He comes back in a body that the world around can see. But even then, it's still hard for the disciples even to see that God was really with them. It wasn't easy for them to see, because at one point in time we see Philip saying to Jesus, "Lord, show us the Father and that will be enough for us," in John 14:8-10. What was Jesus' response to Philip? "If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. You want the Father's presence, he's here. I'm here." And all the other names of God that we've been discussing over the last couple months, those are present in Christ. So not only do we see all the different attributes of God, the characteristics of God, but we actually have God present among man. We also see the same picture of God in the temple and Jesus' discussion with the Pharisees. After Jesus had cleared out the temple courts from the money changers and the people selling merchandise, we read John 2:18-21. It says, "Then the Jews demanded of him, 'What miraculous sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this?' Jesus answered them, 'Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days.' The Jews replied, 'It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you are going to raise it in 3 days?' But the temple he had spoken of was his body. God had tabernacled with us through Christ. So that temple could not be destroyed. And we could not destroy the presence of God by destroying the body of Jesus. But also through Christ, we also see that Jerusalem is still not what God desires it to be, the city whose name is Jehovah Shammah, God is there. We read in Matthew 23, 37 to 38, Jesus is saying, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often have I longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Look, your house has left you desolate." So the promise in Ezekiel doesn't look like it applies to Jerusalem yet. We see it again in Luke 19, 37 to 44. Jesus' triumphant entry into Jerusalem. It almost reminds you of David again going into Jerusalem with the presence of God. They're celebrating God's presence. Here, the disciples are celebrating because of the wonderful things that God has done. But then some of the Pharisees come along and say to Jesus, "Rebuke your disciples. Stop them from celebrating. They're celebrating the wrong thing." Very similar to Michael, David's wife, in Jerusalem when he enters that city. They don't know the presence of God. And verses 41 through 44 in Luke 19, this is what it says. It says, "As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it and said, 'If you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes. The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you.'" It points again to God's judgment on Jerusalem. He brought his presence back again in the form of Jesus, and they still rejected the Son. They rejected the presence of God. What's going to happen to Jerusalem soon after that? In AD 70, we'll see it destroyed. Destruction will come against Jerusalem and the temple again. The Jerusalem that Ezekiel referred to. Is this the Jerusalem? This is the Jerusalem where Jesus was arrested and beaten and taken to trial. No, that's not the Jerusalem that Ezekiel's referring to. Where was Jesus crucified? In the Jerusalem that rejected his presence. Where was Jesus buried and raised from the dead? In the Jerusalem where God rejected his where they rejected his presence. And so do things get better in Jerusalem after Jesus rose again? No, because just like in the past when they persecuted the prophets and they killed the ones that would come and speak God's word, they did the same to the Christians. And they persecuted them also. This is not the Jerusalem that Ezekiel's speaking of. What Jerusalem is he speaking of? The new Jerusalem. The Hebrews 11, 9 through 10 says, "By faith he," referring to Abraham, "made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder was God." Who built Jerusalem? People. The physical Jerusalem on this earth was built by people, by man. It was not the builder and architect, it was God. Hebrews 12, 22 through 24. "But you have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all men, to the spirits of righteous men made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel." And another text of the New Jerusalem is in Revelation 21, 1 through 4. It says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there's no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for a husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away.'" That Jerusalem, there will not be an enemy going against the walls. There will not be an enemy with a sword. There will not be famine. There will not be people dashed. We won't see any of the violence that's passed on there in the New Jerusalem. And now we see the tie together with Ezekiel's revelation. God's covenant has always been, I will be your God, and you will be my people. And God's purpose is that we would live with him forever. Jehovah Shema, God is there. Now, what about application? What do I do with this now? If you don't know Christ here, you don't know his presence. And you stand outside the city of the New Jerusalem. And the violence that I talked about earlier that was went against Jerusalem and the people that were in the city, it's worse if you don't know Christ. Because one day you'll stand in eternal judgment, and it's not just a couple years of going through that judgment. It's worse. And so you'll go through that through an eternity. Because anger, God's anger that was provoked to destroy Jerusalem, that anger will burn forever against those who reject him. So rejecting his presence, you will be rejecting God forever. And you'll be subject to the anguish that he gives. That's not the place to be. God's grace watches over us all. And right now, we're in a place where God's grace is there. There's an opportunity to know Jesus. If you don't know him, you're open to more judgment than what we've seen in this world, and the violence that we've seen in this world. Don't reject them. If you do know him, there's good news. And 2 Corinthians 3:18 says, and we who with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory are being transformed into his likeness with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord who is a spirit. We desire his presence because we desire to be transformed into his glory. And so we want to continue to seek him. Now, how do we get transformed? We do what we've learned from the prophets. We get rid of the idols. We get rid of the things in our lives that keep us away from God's presence. The things that would subject God to keeping us at hand's length. The good thing is we have Christ. And Christ draws us near to his presence. King Josiah, who came after Manasseh, was zealous to remove anything that could point away from God. We have to have that same zeal in him. A question. Do you and I see that the city that we talked about is not a current physical Jerusalem? Ezekiel is not the current physical Jerusalem. We can't get caught up in what we have in this world. We have to have our eyes fixed on things above, not on things on this earth. There are several reasons why. One, we're going to be sharing the future Jerusalem with brothers and sisters who are overseas in different situations than we are. Some of them in prisons. Some of them are being tortured to reject Christ. Some of them, if they accept Christ, and it's not the religion of their parents or their family, they could be subject to death because they reject the other religion. They're not looking for this world's gold to set them free. They're not looking for the world's pleasures and the comforts and everything that we might even have. They don't have that to look to, but they have something to look to that we have also. We have the New Jerusalem to look to. And that's where eyes are fixed, because that is permanent. What we have now can be gone tomorrow. We have a hope. Because we're going to share an eternity one day with the architect and builder of God. We will be in a city where God is there permanently. We won't have to deal with this corrupt situation that we deal with in this world. It's rough sometimes, just what we have to deal with. And if we get our mind focused on what goes on around us, it can be really frustrating. But that's not our future. And so we can let God do these things and take care of those things himself. We don't have to sometimes. We can let God do what he wants to do, how he wants to do it. So I can't get my eyes so focused on what's going on there that it pulls me away from my vision of where I'm going in the future. We sang the song Amazing Grace today, and at the end it talks about when we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. This is the future we have, because we will be with our God, and we won't have to deal with any of these things that we go through now. Jehovah Shammah. God is there. God's here now, but God will bring us to a complete ending in his city, in his presence. Let's pray.